Hello and welcome to another episode of PhD Pending, the podcast for early career humanities scholars. My name is Anne Mahler and I have a PhD in English literature. Together we will deep dive into different aspects of PhD life and explore what it really means to do a PhD in the humanities. I really hope you enjoyed the first episode of the season. That was also the first part of my conversation with my old friend Martin about the similarities and differences of humanities and science PhD programs. If you haven't listened to it yet, you might want to pause this episode and go back to listen to part one, where Martin and I talk about how applications, funding, and everyday research life works for a PhD student in the sciences. In part two, we cover more similarities and differences between the two disciplines, and we start things off with conferences and how they might work a little bit different for PhD students in the sciences.
And you were talking about like giving talks earlier, so I suppose my next question is, tell me about the conferences of it all. Are there like conferences that you would go to? What do they look like? How do you, and even like publications, right? How do you make sure that as you go through your PhD, you present your findings and you network with other scientists? And is there like a publishing quota? Because for us, it was very much a case of, even when I got my funding just for fees, so all my student fees were covered from my department, and one of the requirements was I had to attend one conference within Ireland a year and one international one. And I had to put like a publication out at a certain stage, and it helped me like progress through the program. So I suppose my question is, what are their requirements? And if no, what were your own kind of experiences with conferences and with publications?
Well, when it comes to conferences, I don't think there are requirements. But and I'll get to that in a minute. Publications, I mean, you must publish.
Okay.
Of course.
Okay.
And, you know, in academia, well, in science, I don't presume to speak for the humanities, but in the sciences, publishing is the lifeblood of any working group.
Like, yeah.
If you don't publish, you have done nothing. Only what you publish happened, basically, right?
Okay. So, happen.
Exactly. and so, you know, you will eventually, of course, publish, right? But that happens along the way, apparently. And if you're lucky, you get to write your own paper. I say if you're lucky because A, it is a good thing to know how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You should definitely learn to do that. And B, if you're writing your own paper, you kind of control the pace. You know, you know when it's finished. If it's someone else's responsibility, that never works out. When it comes to talking, because, you know, you led into this topic with talks, mm-hmm. I'm not sure how that relates to conferences, because you rarely get to give a talk at the conference.
What? That's really interesting.
Usually when you go to conferences, you should definitely go to conferences, and any good PI will kind of make you,
mm-hmm.
right, go to a conference. There are usually international conferences,
mm-hmm.
and so one of the beauties of going is that you get to go on a, well, you're nice not on trip. Vacation because you're there for work, right?
Well, it is
work. But still, like, I had a trip to Spain, for example, and that was
nice.
Very lovely.
Yeah.
Right? But usually, at least the conferences that I attended, you know, there were invited speakers, and
yeah.
they were PIs and professors and, you know, people from all over the world relevant
right.
to that field of research. And they did bring their PhD students,
mm-hmm.
but the PhD students would usually present posters. I think I've only seen one PhD student actually give a talk at such a conference,
okay.
Because her PI couldn't make it in time and she substituted.
Oh.
So it was her talk about her topic and, you know,
mm-hmm.
her research topic. And it is usually, in my experience, the PhD students who put together the talks, because, you know, the PIs go, oh, damn, I have a conference in like 2 weeks. Could you put together a 20-minute talk for me, please? Yeah, thank you. And so, you know, you put together the talk, but you don't get to present it usually.
That's really interesting because I always wondered what quote unquote poster presentations were about. I never really understood that in the context of like sciences and conferences and how that relates to
humanities.
It
is very important.
But if you understand that you are working for a PI, and then it's almost like in the sciences, it appears to be a bit more hierarchical, almost, because I wouldn't have to do any work for my PhD supervisor, who I suppose would somewhat equate to a PI.
Yeah, I guess.
In that regard, I never had to like do anything. And I also, just from academic Twitter and all that stuff, I know that fast authoring an article or publication is like really important.
It is a big deal.
And for like the sciences, you have like 14 contributing authors.
Well, you shouldn't really, but sometimes you do.
Sometimes you do. And I look at my publications and like I submit to journals by myself. It's like an article I wrote, I researched it, like it's all me.
That is not a thing a science PhD student will do usually.
Okay.
Well, first of all, it costs a lot of money actually.
Wait, what?
To submit an article to a scientific journal for them to publish that.
You pay
the journal to publish the article. Okay. And then, of course, you know, your article needs to be considered for publication. And it is always good if there's, you know, established the group leader, professor or whatever at the back of the author list.
Mm-hmm.
So that you're not immediately like, you know, maybe next issue. And then someone forgets it somewhere. And then you ask about that. And and you get it sent back with, I don't know. I don't know if I've met a PhD student who submitted their own articles just so. I don't think that is a thing.
Whoa.
You know, you work closely with your PI on what goes into the article, what the paper should be like, how it should be presented. And then if anyone can contribute anything interesting, you ask if they want to contribute, and then your author list grows, of course, and then some of the PIs submit it. That's how that went.
Interesting. That is very different to how... And it's also, like, let's talk about turnaround times, because obviously, when I think about the sciences, and maybe not so much for your field, because, you know, in that time, in that area of chemistry, I don't know. I'm just talking. Like, I talk as if I know, but I don't know. But in the sciences, to me, like, publication of some of the results seem more pressing because of the, you know, technological developments that are going on. Or I'm thinking about medicine and, you know, like, so much stuff is happening all the time and the innovations and, like, technology and all of that. Whereas...
Well, it also makes it very competitive, you know, if you...
Yeah.
Happen to work with a like methodology that is not super far spread, right? There's maybe you get a certain method. Like we went with EPR spectroscopy, which is well established, but it's rather rare.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there are methods that pretty much every lab has because they're kind of basic tools.
Mm-hmm.
But if you work with something fancy that's not too far spread, chances are some other group might be interested in the same stuff as you. And so there's also a competitive
aspect
to that, to get your stuff out there.
Because sometimes the turnaround for humanities publications can be up to 3 years. You submit an article or something and it can take the journal or whatever, wherever you want to publish that piece, if it might be an edited collection or whatever. I know people who've waited over 3 years to get the publication out.
Oh, wow.
So I know from just anecdotally that turnaround time is quicker in the sciences. So I was just wondering what your experience is.
It is definitely quicker than 3 years.
Mm.
But it can range anywhere between a couple of weeks to a couple of months. That can happen.
Okay.
It depends on, you know, how big the journal is that you publish in. It very much depends on who the reviewers are, and they are anonymous, of course, for a lot of reasons. it then depends on like really how much they want to pick your article apart.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes there's a lot of stalling tactics there, or maybe there is a special issue for a big publication that, I don't know, it's some journal that does a special issue on the biology of special fungus.
Mm-hmm.
And then things that might be related to that get submitted.
Cool.
And then they sift through that, and then turnaround times are relatively low, of course, because they have that special issue plan, then it should go out in time and all that. But if it's just something, then anywhere between a couple of weeks and a couple of months, really.
Makes sense. Okay. Way quicker than in the humanities. Very interesting. And I suppose one of the things that you and I have also talked about before is that we have very differing opinions on imposter syndrome. We've done imposter syndrome episodes on this show about how it can be really like be an obstacle to like your research and your development and like how you feel about things and all of that. And I remember mentioning that to you, and you had a very different reaction to what I thought you would have. And we had a conversation about this over text, and I would just love to recap that because I feel like it is such a different view to anything that I've had in the humanities before. And it's so much more positive. So I would love for you to share that.
More positive. Okay.
Because for us, imposter syndrome is something very detrimental. It's something very, very, very negative. You have it and it keeps you from doing things. It makes you feel like you're not worthy. It makes you feel like you're not supposed to be in that space. And it really puts you down and it's holding you back. It's like when you're in a nightmare and you're trying to run, but you can't get anywhere. It's almost like, at least for me personally, that's what it's like. It might be different for other people. But I remember you saying something very differently.
Hmm. Well, there is some of that is definitely a thing. I remember I was in a seminar type situation with peers, like fellow PhD students. You know, and it was very relaxed. There were no big shots there that would come crashing down on us or anything. And this colleague of mine talked about things that I absolutely knew I heard in some lecture in second or third semester.
Mm-hmm.
I knew for a fact that I should understand what she was saying.
Mm-hmm.
And I was completely lost.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And then, you know, after the talk, people started asking questions that sounded like very intelligent questions to me, and I still had no idea what was going on. And it felt kind of awful because, you know, I should know this, but... So yeah, there is a bit of that. And then, you know, you go to maybe some sort of conference and you get to see all the people who have done that and for a very long time. There will usually be PIs or like graduates there, and they will talk about things and you will be absolutely lost.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have... Well, you still have to develop like a sense for the bigger picture.
Hmm.
The sciences are so incredibly interconnected,
mm-hmm.
that really there is an impossible amount of things to know if you want to deep dive into something, right?
Right.
It's not very useful to say, oh, you know, it's okay if you don't know biology, you're a chemist. Because there's so much crossover between these two,
mm-hmm.
right? And... You know, when you get then to the higher level, to PhD projects, they are so intricate that you do need to cross over a lot.
Right.
And you realize at some point that it's impossible for you to know all these things. And it's not a big deal if you don't, you know. If you at least pay attention as to what they're saying and you make some notes and then read up on it later for a bit, maybe that's perfectly fine. So, you know, but you need to build that confidence to say, okay, it's fine if I have no idea what's going on here. That's fine. The flip side to that, I guess, is that I've seen a couple of times is the idea that you do your research and you get super pumped up about it. You know, you intimately get to know your project And you will probably spend a lot of time in the lab working on that project.
Hmm.
And so it feels like a relationship, really, that you have, because it is a full-time relationship. And you look at that, and it's fine, and at some point you go, is that really a thing here? Like, why would anyone care about this, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I care about this because I've been working on that for, I don't know, 2 years. But is it, like, would someone be interested?
Hmm.
That is a very, very nasty door to open, because, you know, then you start looking at the works that other people do, and they seem so much cooler.
Yeah.
Right. Then, you know, I was working there with these proteins and they did cool shit. It was really nice. But it was more on the basics side of things than the application side of things.
Right.
Because there's just still a long process before we get there. But others were working on applications, things like conductive polymers, you know, for solar panels or whatever. And you think, like, holy shit, those guys are going to solve the energy crisis. Right. And meanwhile, I'm sitting here playing with my, right. And
with your fungus.
Yeah. And you can get really, that can really get you in the guts when you kind of convince yourself that what you're doing is nice and all, but it's really meh.
Kind of like a relevance question.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And then you have the extreme version of that is that, you know, you compare yourself to people who changed the world, like, I don't know, Einstein, Newton, Hawking.
Yeah.
You have to realize that you're not them. And you will likely not change the world significantly with your PhD.
Yeah.
And that's fine too.
I think that's...
Right? And you need to experience those and then balance them very carefully so that you get excited enough about your own research to keep you motivated, but also, you know, humble enough to say, okay, this is what I can do and this is how much I can know before I have a mental breakdown. And so, you know, let's keep it at that. It's fine.
I think there's a good bit of overlap and just like even the way we approach PhDs and like if I read over my first proposal for my PhD thesis now, just like the amount of stuff I wanted to look at,
yeah.
Like I wanted to solve world hunger in my proposal. And what I actually ended up doing maybe was planting like one seed.
Yeah.
If I put that into a metaphor.
Yeah.
And I was going through the exact same process. Like, nobody's going to be interested in what I'm doing. Like, I like what I do. And, like, I, in fairness, picked, like, a somewhat, like, sensationalist, fancy kind of topic. But at the same time, there are things where, like, oh, you know, is anyone interested in this? Kind of. So I do understand. And I think there's a lot of overlap in that. But you also talked about this being, like, somewhat of a motivator.
Yeah, well, that is what where conferences and seminars, especially in a relaxed peer atmosphere, are super important because. So my project was funded by this CRC, this conglomerate of groups coming together, all revolved around a certain central question, and then there were different projects exploring aspects of the central question in different ways, right?
Right.
And I was kind of the weird step cousin in that. Circle because everyone was dealing with the polymers or very well established projects that had to do with Alzheimer's and neurodegenerative diseases in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was there and I was related to that on a purely physical aspect, right? Like my proteins did kind of sort of a similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I was there.
Right.
Right. But those people were like, it sounded to me in the very beginning, like those people were going to cure Alzheimer's. Right. And I was playing with my fungus. That was really rough. But then,
yeah.
You know, within this context, we had every 3 weeks or so, we had a doctoral student seminar and then we would rotate, you know, talks. Everyone had to give one eventually.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave my first talk and people were genuinely interested.
Oh.
And it genuinely flew pretty well. And you get interesting and insightful questions and that helps, right?
Yeah.
A lot, actually.
Yeah.
And at conferences, it's the same, just bigger.
Right.
Right? You don't get to give a talk usually, but you present a poster and you do try to grab the attention of people you know who might give some valuable input.
Right.
It's not necessarily about the networking that they should know about you,
mm-hmm.
because you can't be sure that they will remember anyway.
Yeah.
But just to get, so that you get something out of them. Right? You drag them to your poster,
right.
You explain what that is, you ask them what you want to ask them, and then you leech all their knowledge, insight, and opinion that you can. But that's also kind of a bit of a confidence boost, or it can be at least, right?
Yeah.
One further aspect is then that you need to learn to stand up for your research.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been thinking about that. This oral exam at the end of the PhD, it's called Viva.
Yep.
Yeah, we literally call it a defense.
Mm-hmm.
Because you are defending.
Yeah.
You're not defending... you're not exactly defending your research.
Yeah.
Your research should be proper.
Yeah.
Solid science. But you need to trust that it is.
Yeah.
And you're actually defending your trust in your own research.
Right. Kind of your approach to
it. Exactly. That is what is being attacked. Mm-hmm. Right? It's like, yeah, it looks kind of cool, but how can you know that this is good science? Right? Did you do that right? It's like, yeah, I did. And I'm confident in what I did. That's what you're defending.
And here is why. Yeah.
Right? You need to build the ability to stand behind your research at a certain point, right?
Hmm.
Scientists are one of the most humble people I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Pick any publication, it will be brimming with humble phrases like, we don't want to say this is what it is, but we have reason to believe because, and you know, always like
keep it calm and open.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you can't fly with that on a high level forever. At some point you have to say, no, this is good work.
Yeah.
I did good work.
Yeah.
And what I concluded from that is solid.
Yeah.
If it's wrong, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But to the best of my knowledge, this is how things are.
Yeah.
And stand behind that.
Yeah. Which reminds me that I remember you said doing your defense, like it was a public defense, right?
It was.
Like our vivas usually are closed. I only had a viva with my PhD supervisor who was not to say anything. He was just there to observe and to support and jump in if something went really, really to shits, which it didn't, thank God. External supervisor from a different university who would be well-versed in the theories that I'd be working with. Internal supervisor whose research would be roughly related to my field. And then someone from a different department who would make sure that the processes were followed in a proper way, kind of just observing that everything went right. I remember you telling me that like your family and friends came to your defense.
Yeah.
And like, didn't they like open like drinks in the back row or something?
Oh yeah, they did before I was allowed to have one myself. I was very rude.
So you were defending your PhD and your friends were sitting in the back basically drinking beer, chilling.
It is encouraged. So what I hear is that PhD defenses in the sciences are not universally the same in Germany. It very much depends on where you are.
But
it also depends on the exact institute that you're at. So there is usually a bit of a difference between physics and chemistry, let's say, right?
Right, right.
But the general gist here in Halle is that you get invited properly, formally, to defend your thesis. And a committee will be formed basically from any professor that feels like they would like to take part in that.
Okay.
As far as I'm aware, for a chemistry defense, professors of philosophy and music could show up. That, of course, never happens, but it is technically allowed, right?
Okay.
So this committee is formed. Your PI is always a member of the committee.
Right.
You give a talk of 30 minutes.
Yep.
And then they pick you apart for an hour.
And
it is encouraged that other people that are interested come and watch this. And given that, you know, it's not really post-corona, but, you know, after the first brunt, it was online. The defense, one of the first online that we had, but we still had regulations in place that allowed in this large room for there to be a couple of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really good that they were there because I would have hated to speak in an empty room just into my laptop for an hour and a half. So that sucked. So my dad was there, my mom was there, and then a couple of friends, and then one who would watch the technical side of things. So But yeah, it is encouraged to be public. And in fact, you are encouraged, and I highly encourage PhD students in the science to watch defenses, other defenses that go before them.
Oh, you can watch them.
Well, yeah. Well, there will be defenses happening. You should go.
You should go to a public one.
Right.
I get you. You should go.
Like, if the topic is somewhat interesting and mm-hmm. vaguely related, that's good enough. Because one, you will get a feeling for what it's like. Like, what can you expect? How does that go?
Yeah.
Two, if your defense is near and you have an idea of who might be in your committee, it is always good to check that out. Because, you know, people tend to ask in the same general direction, right?
There's a
professor of the technical side of chemistry and engineering and all that. And he has a very straightforward direction in which all of his questions usually go. And if you mm-hmm. know that, you know, you have a better idea of what to prepare for.
Yeah.
And so just like scouting the field, I would say. So I highly encourage people to go there. Plus, usually after the defense, there will be, you know, snacks and drinks and all that. And you can probably grab a glass. So that's kind of nice.
Nice. And I suppose we've been going on for a good while already, but I want to touch on the very last topic, and that is teaching. You were saying earlier that depending on the funding, so when we chatted before the recording, that you don't necessarily have to teach.
Mm.
Some of the programs, now that I reflect, I think, don't really have that either in the humanities. But I remember conversations that we had like weeks ago about teaching and even just like class sizes and the practical side of teaching in terms of like being in the lab and all of that. And for us, it's very much we do tutorials that accompany lectures for first year students when they are fresh babies and they come in. And then maybe we get a chance to, in the second year, do a seminar that we can design based on our research interests, which then people, like ranging from, depending on who's signing up, right, 5 to 25 people would attend. That's at least what it's like in Ireland. And that's what I experienced. And sometimes when you're lucky, you get to maybe do like a lecture here or there if, you know, your supervisor is getting sick or if they're on leave or anything like that. I remember you telling me that your kind of lab works and all of that, you had way smaller groups. So tell us a small bit about that.
Well, that really, again, depends on what you're supervising. Because, like, basically, science is the two things. Mm-hmm. It is the theoretical kind of work and then the hands-on lab work.
Right.
And those need to be supervised, of course. So, and usually, as a PhD student in the sciences, you will be in, put in charge of maybe a tutorial or a seminar
mm-hmm.
or lab courses.
Right.
Right. Rarely both, but it can happen. And what lab courses you will supervise depends on what your group is. So, since I was in physical chemistry, I would supervise physical chemistry lab courses for the most part.
Right.
Obviously. How they are, that depends on where you are. Like in Halle, there is a basic physical lab course, physical chemistry lab course that has been like that for, I don't know, ever.
Mm.
Right? We still do it that way because it works very well.
Right.
And then how big the classes, the groups are, that depends on how many students sign up. In chemistry, it's maybe 20 or so. In pharmacy, it's maybe 260.
Jesus.
So there's that.
Right.
Right? And the lab courses are very different. Well, of course they are, because, you know, students go through these lab courses and they're supposed to learn different things. And depending on what lab course you supervise, it really differs like day and night. It can be quite different. But generally speaking, when you're working with the lab courses, you will have a handful of students to keep an eye on.
Right.
Right? My groups were usually like 2 or 3 people.
Right.
And then perhaps in one lab course, I would have 2 or 3 groups to supervise. So that would also be 10 people, mm-hmm. but in chunks of 3 separate little groups, right? So you don't have to juggle like 50 people at once.
I get you. And then also the marking of it all makes it easier, right? If you only have two or three people, if you have to mark...
Well, you still have 10 people.
Oh, okay. I get you.
Right?
All together. Yeah.
Although
yeah,
sometimes, you know, given that they have to handle lab reports, they would usually do that as a group. So it would still be only three lab reports.
Oh, okay.
That does make a little bit easier. So it's not like, marking 50 reports or essays handed in.
Mm-hmm.
But... like I said, depending on the class size, if you get 260 students showing up, that is still, I don't know, like
that's an 80, awful.
80 lab reports to read or so. It can be quite a lot, but
yeah,
you know, and you have to read all of that.
Of course,
because
you do. Yeah.
You know, in physical chemistry, it's a lot of numbers and formulae and calculations and all that, and you can just check if that makes sense, right? Or you have a sheet where you've done the calculations before, and if the result's correct, you give it a pass, and if not, then you give it a no. But there's text in between that you have to read carefully for every single lab report, because that is where they draw conclusions and make arguments. And there's a lot of potential for...
fucking up?
I would have said missteps, but yeah, that... And so you have to read that all anyway. So,
yeah.
But how much it is really depends on what lab course you're supervising.
Yeah, that makes sense.
On the other hand, I mean, you know, if you're supervising organic chemistry where people like handle pretty difficult and dangerous substances, right? The lab reports are not really that. Like you look at a bit of data and you're like, yeah, okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
Right? But you have to worry that your students will set themselves on fire. So there's a trade-off, I suppose.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's a responsibility that comes with it as well.
I mean, I will say that the chances in the lab courses I supervised for students to set themselves on fire were slim, but I wouldn't put it past all of them.
And having said all of that, two questions that I ask all my guests on the show. Number one, what is some piece of advice that you would give your first year PhD self?
There's two types of networking, really. There's the professional networking, and everybody we keep telling you how important that is. Like, oh, that's the most important thing. And you know, it is very important, but there's also the off-work networking that you can do. And you definitely should. Because connecting well with your peers... It gives you an automatic type of outlet.
Yeah.
That can keep your motivation up.
Mm-hmm.
It can help release pressure and anxiety that you have when you're like just feel overworked.
Mm-hmm.
Which mostly means that you are overworked. And if you just like sitting down in front of the institute because you know you're getting home late and they are getting home late, you're having a beer together before going home.
Yeah.
That can help.
Yeah.
Like network. Outside of work, right?
Yeah.
So that I cannot recommend that highly enough. That is something I would definitely do.
Great advice. And the last question I have for you, what is your favorite productivity hack?
Productivity hack. Well, you know, I always have a motivational problem until I get a time problem.
So you're one of those.
Yes, I am one of those. A productivity hack is when you open your computer to write something, for example, put on one album that you really like of music, one, shut off everything else that you don't need.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You need something that you write and one album.
Yeah.
Write until the album's done.
Yeah.
Then take a break. It's amazing how much you can get done when you have like this short of a deadline that's still kind of sort of enjoyable, right? And that also works for lab work for me, because there were like, you can fiddle around with sample preparations a little bit and then it doesn't take 20 minutes but 40, and before you know it the day is half and you haven't really done anything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you do something like that, that for me that works quite well. If you're not into music, I have no idea what to tell you.
I've had similar techniques because it reminds me of the Pomodoro technique where people like set an egg clock or an egg timer, you know, and it's like 10 minutes and then you get a 2 minute break or 10 minutes or 15 minutes and a 5 minute break.
The problem with that is sometimes you take a while to get going, right?
Yeah.
And if at 10 minutes you're on an absolute high riding the wave, that is the worst exactly. possible time to take
yeah.
a break.
Yeah.
But in larger chunks, you know, you can slow down in yeah. between. You don't have, if it's an album that, I don't know, has like a couple songs and is like 60 minutes, mm-hmm. you don't have to work 60 minutes straight full yeah. power. You can't even do that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, you have a very concise time frame in which you know you can do a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And then examine it critically afterwards. Like, you know, this was an hour. Does that look like an hour's worth of work?
Yeah.
If it does, nice. If it doesn't,
what know, happened?
Have a closer look.
Yeah, I get you. No, that makes sense. Brilliant. And having said all that, is there any place where people can find you on the interwebs if they want to know more about you, about your work, about your publications, about your band?
Well, about the band, it is Sir Gerry, that is G-E-R-R-Y on Spotify, Apple Music. I shun Facebook these days.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? But yeah, it's Martin Foltz, and you can find me on ResearchGate, probably.
Cool. And we'll put that link into the show notes. Is there anything else that we haven't really discussed that you quickly want to touch on before we close?
I really can't think of anything.
Brilliant. Then that is it for this week's episode of PhD Pending. And thank you so much for listening to the episode. And thanks very much for coming on and sharing your wisdom with us. If you are doing a PhD in the sciences, or you have any kind of overlaps with your own research in humanities, or have friends in the sciences, let us know on our social media. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at PhdPenningPod. And if you want to support the show, of course, you can either become a patron on Patreon or buy us a coffee on buymeacoffee.com/PhdPenningPod. You can also write an email to PhdPenningPod@gmail.com. And we will see you again here in 2 weeks' time. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
This episode of PhD Pending was written and produced by me, Anne Mahler. Artwork by Jerome Kelleher. Support the show and rate us 5 stars in your favorite podcast app. You can also subscribe to our Patreon for exclusive bonus content, or if you prefer a once-off donation, head to our Buy Me a Coffee page. The links to both are in the show notes. You can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at PhdPendingPod, or send an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com.